Appreciate that. The order for today, and we're going to go till about 8 o'clock and hopefully not be in the middle of something at 8 o'clock, but we're going to try to take items up in this order, and we'll see how far we go. House Bill 288 for the introduction of the committee substitute. House Bill 315 for consideration of amendments and possibly moving that bill out. House Bill 27 for consideration of amendment and moving that bill out. House Bill 399, also, I think, for consideration of any amendments. And then I don't believe we have any for that bill. And then House Bill 260. And we'll see how far we get. So that is the plan. Also want to again mention that we do have a full schedule for the Wednesday daytime meeting. So if we're not able to get through these items, what we'd like to ask is for folks to plan on a Wednesday evening meeting, and then hopefully by the two evening meetings we'll be able to catch up on the items that have been left behind. So we're going to start with House Bill 288. Mr. Vice Chair.
Madam Chair, I move that the committee adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 288, version D30-LS1155/D as a working document.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. I'm going to hand the gavel over to Representative Josephson while I put myself at the testimony table to present the committee substitute. Good evening, Representative Garantar, House District 19 in Anchorage. Happy to present the committee substitute. So we're looking at version D for House Bill 288. And just want to start with a little bit of a review of this bill from the earlier presentation, just to remind us because it was so long ago. And this bill, if folks will remember, deals entirely with the minimum tax. And currently, the minimum tax in statute is 4% of the gross value at the point of production. The original version of the bill increased that to 7%. And this is just kind of a review of some of the things we've talked about where Alaska stands now. Why we're considering this legislation is that our effective tax rate is one of the lowest in the country at the low price levels. Keeping in mind the way the calculation works, we had this previously as a slide from the earlier presentation, so we're hovering in the $60 range. The first column shows you the $60 numbers and gets you down to the minimum tax, which is about $2. And so that's right now what the state is receiving in severance tax is about $2 per barrel. And then the second column shows you the $60 with a 7% minimum tax, so that would bump that up to about $3.51, and then continues on. And we did the low cost and the high cost estimates as just sort of relevant examples there. And one of the things that we're concerned about is what happens in the low price environment with the increase in the minimum tax. And so just want folks to keep in mind a couple of those numbers there as we think about it. The lease expenditure line, when we first started talking about making changes to Senate Bill 21, the tax structure that's in place right now, that lease expenditure line was about $50. And so over the last few years, that has been scaled back significantly through cuts in staffing as well as some decreases in work that was happening up on the North Slope. And what you see when that happens is a lag in that kind of activity. So the companies aren't able to immediately respond overnight if there's a dip in price. And it takes them some time to make those adjustments in terms of laying down a rig or being able to reduce the number of staff they have. So what we wanted to consider was what could happen in a low price environment. Should we see something like what we saw happen before with the drop down to the $27, and if that follows a period where the prices have been a little bit higher, right, like they are right now, where the companies might have shifted in the other direction and started to spend some money again, then wanted to be careful about what that could do to the overall finances. So if you'll recall, part of this conversation is just looking at the big picture when we think about increases in production, how much profit for barrel, how many barrels total, how much revenue to the state. And we did some calculations here that would show you different different number of barrels per day increase, as well as how much money you'd receive in taxable barrels and royalty barrels. And it's really not until we get up into the 100,000 new barrels per day and above that the numbers are significant enough that they could actually make a dent in the overall financial situation that we're challenged with right now. The royalty and production tax revenue, and this just sort of shows it as a bar graph and compares it to our estimated deficit. This slide could be adjusted for the new spring forecast that came out recently, and that would put it a few hundred million dollars less. So the estimated deficit now is more like $2.3 billion instead of $2.7 billion. But these bar graphs, you can show the estimated fiscal impact from 20,000 new barrels, 50,000 new barrels, and 100,000 new barrels, and you can see the significant difference in the overall height of the lines is an indication of the lack of revenue. So the committee substitute version, instead of going from 4 to 7 at all prices, does a stair step. And existing statute has a stair step down under the $25 mark. It goes down 4, 3, 2, 1. So we didn't make any adjustments to the downward stair step that happens under $25, but instead on the upward side. And so between $25 and $40, we left that at 4%, again, recognizing the challenge that could happen in a scenario where instead of it being $60 there with the 4% minimum tax, if that said $40, right, so you can just kind of adjust the math all the way through and see what that $20 difference would make. And so what we wanted to do was be careful about the impact at lower prices. So between 25 and 40, we leave that at 4%. Between 40 and 55%, we increase it to 5%. Between 55 and 65 to 6%, and then 65 and above to 7%. Recognizing that what we've always said is above 50 is in the profit margin, and that is relative to old spending that we would say it was closer to 50. The increase is really happening after the point where we think that the companies are in the profit, making profits, and so have a little bit of ability to make those adjustments. Even at 7%, the minimum tax remains one of the lowest around. This is effective severance tax rates for some of the different jurisdictions. We know it's hard to compare Alaska to other places because there are so many sort of differences about development here. We often compare us to other countries rather than to other states, but just this was something we tried to find something that was pretty recent that would give us some comparisons. So if we push ourselves into that 7% mark, you can see where we rate relative to some of the other states. And it's important that this is, effective tax rates because, for example, with our tax, it has a 35% base rate, but that's nowhere near what people pay as an effective tax rate. And just as a reminder, if you look on that first column here, right now in the $60 range with the revenue and spending information we have from Department of Revenue, if we look at the tax as a percentage of GVPP, right, that's the 4% because that's what the minimum tax is set at. But if we look at it as a percentage of PTV, which is production tax value, the PTV, remember, is the value after you've deducted your transportation expenses and all of your lease expenditures. So it truly represents, if you have a net profit system, the profit available after expenses are considered. And so right now, ours is about 9%. Is an effective tax rate for as a percentage of PTV. So if we take a look at the fiscal notes, and everyone should have a fiscal note to accompany this conversation. I believe we had passed out the fiscal notes from the earlier version, so hopefully everybody has both. And for example, and the fiscal note looks like this rather than a traditional fiscal note, what I'm looking for. Because they've been producing these different formats for us. But if you look at the FY19, and if we need to take an Eddie's for a moment for folks to get a copy of that.
Everyone have it? It's at the back of your CS-288 packet.
So the adjusted fiscal note takes into account the, and it says HB 288 with possible amendment and their estimated fiscal impacts based on spring 2018. So this fiscal note or fiscal information is for the CS, and it's based on the most recent revenue forecast, the spring forecast that just came out. For FY19, you can see that the total fiscal impact would be about $64 million, and that's because it would be for half a year based on the offset between the fiscal year and the calendar year, the way the taxes are done. And then if you have the old fiscal information, what you can see is really where this bill can make a difference is in the next few fiscal years. Beyond that, it's similar to the previous version of the bill because of the price forecast. And when I think about some of the work that we're hoping to accomplish, people have brought up the working group, and of course with session in, we have not had an opportunity to hold a meeting for that, but I hope that will happen soon. We'll have hopefully a lengthy interim where that work can continue in a bipartisan, bicameral way. And if we think about bringing something before the body next year for consideration, of course, don't know if something would be considered, and don't know that really the work that will come out of the working group will result in a product that brings in more revenue. But a big part of the motivation for that work is just to try and have a system that overall works better, even if it doesn't bring in new revenue. In doing that, we can make it easier to predict what the revenue is going to be, and we can do things like de-link it to price, and so those are some of the things that could make it work better for the state in terms of understanding what our revenue is going to be and not having such fluctuations. So I don't want us to think of the working group as something that's going to produce a proposal that is focused on increasing revenue. That could be something that comes out of it, but it could also be that the working group comes up with suggestions or proposals that overall make the tax structure just work better for the state. And even if we did something like that, I anticipate that it would take at least a couple of years for that work to be completed, and now everybody having been through it can see how much time it takes to really do something, especially if we want to do a big overhaul. That would be a very lengthy process. And so I don't think that we would see a new tax structure in place before probably the FY22 fiscal year. And I just mention that because if you compare the fiscal note for this possible amendment to the previous one, it's the same in those out years. And I think the importance of talking about this bill at this time is really what happens in the next 3 years, the FY19, 20, and 21, where that additional revenue could make a big difference as we're trying to sort out our fiscal challenges. That's all I have at this time, Mr. Chairman.
Questions? Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is still a bad idea. I look at the chart that you have here as far as the royalty barrels revenue versus the taxable barrels. The royalty share is four times the revenue. So if you have an extra 100,000 barrels a day, it's $300 million to the Treasury. The bulk of that is our royalty share. And I guess I guess I'm concerned that the significant increase in the taxable rate and yet another change in the oil tax structure. I'm concerned that we're going to adversely impact what we've seen as a pretty steady, if not growth, at least holding the line on production on the North Slope. And I'm concerned that we're going to be mucking around with this tax structure in a way that doesn't encourage the kind of investment that's necessary to, you know, for the exploration, and just a hundred thousand barrel a day increase as your projection here is like $300 million into the state treasury. So, I think, yeah, I'm concerned that this is going to compromise our ability to attract and the kind of investment that's necessary to, you know, for resources. I mean, I don't think anything's changed. I mean, from the standpoint of, I'd be interested in your perspective on how this is going to encourage or attract investment.
Through the chair to Representative Birch, well, one thing that is clear is that Alaska remains a profitable place to do business. There was just an article in the ADN. BP reports annual profit for Alaska businesses at $118 million with massive tax cut boost, and goes on to talk about, and there's several different numbers. I'm not going to go through the whole article, but the 118, just keep in mind, accounts for a lot of other things in terms of what the total profit from Alaska was that was brought in for that company. And we have to balance a lot of competing needs, and our tax is one of the lowest in the country. It's the lowest the state of Alaska's ever had. And we have other proposals under consideration that are, you know, could be a big boost of money to the oil industry. And this is an exercise in trying to balance the different demands for the state and do something that's reasonable. Just like last year, we had a first version introduced, listened to concerns from industry, and scaled back the committee substitute version. Of course, some people think this scales it back too far, especially when some of these news articles have come out recently and have received communications about that. So I guess it's just our job to figure out what the right balance is.
Thank you.
Yes, and I'll take some questions, but I'll just add to that one of the things that Representative Tarr, that strikes me about the chart that Representative Birch referred to is when I first arrived here in 2013, there was really no discussion of royalty barrels because, of course, prices were different. No one's to blame for that. No one individual, I suppose. But royalty barrels were sort of an afterthought in this calculus. And now they've become the dominant theme. And I guess, I don't know if you want to respond to that, but the second part is this 100,000 barrels of additional production. That's a murky picture as well, given that the legacy fields will continue to decrease. I don't know if you want to comment on any of that.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. If you look at the most recent revenue sources book, there's not a predicted increase. There are some potential projects that could come online early 2018. I put together a calendar to try and map out when new projects might come online based on what we know now. And maybe there's 30,000 barrels, some smaller opportunities like that in the near term. It's hard for me to see based on everything I've read and tried to find every article from the last 6 months to a year and read every possibility about projects and where things are. I don't think we'll see 100,000 new barrels of production anytime soon.
Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman Johnson. Through the chair, I'm just wondering, somehow we came up with 7% in 288, and now somehow we're at 4% at 25 to 45% at 40 to 55. Where did the numbers come from originally? Why are they there? Why did we choose those on the original? And then in the CS version, what's the reason for the deviation also? I guess I haven't heard that part yet. Maybe I missed it. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Representative Tarr.
Mm-hmm. Representative Rauscher, through the chair. The numbers go back to Senate Bill 21, and under ACES there was actually a higher minimum tax under the former tax structure, and there was a lot of discussion about what the appropriate minimum tax should be, and it was at 10%, but then it got lowered to the 4% in Senate Bill 21, and so that's what the minimum tax had been. Of course, during the Senate Bill 21 conversation, oil was $110 per barrel, so there was not a lot of time spent thinking about what would happen if you were in this minimum tax environment. It wasn't really a part of the calculation that there would be an extended period of time where the severance tax would operate like a gross tax only at 4%. And so what's been happening over the last couple of years has been, I would say, a surprise or not anticipated based on the conversations we had when that was drafted. I considered, in terms of what number do you pick, basically ran a lot of different math scenarios and tried to figure out what's reasonable and, you know, where can you move, what keeps us, and that's why I think the chart sort of showing where some other states are at is important, you know, what kind of helps us in terms of ranking us relative to other locations. And again, if we go back to this chart, remember the way we calculate our tax is we take the value, we subtract the transportation costs, that gives you the gross value at the point of production, then we subtract the lease expenditures, that gives you the PTV, that's the 23.25, then you do the 35% tax, then you subtract the per barrel credit. And what we wanted to do was be careful that, again, if you think about, instead of that saying $60, if that said $40, then you would have, you know, take $20 off in that entire equation going through. And that's where you get into the really negative numbers in terms of what the tax per net would be. They would all be negative numbers. For example, it would look a lot more like the $60 with high cost lease expenditures. And under those scenarios, that's where the companies are more challenged, because the minimum tax means that they have to pay a tax even if it's not a profitable scenario. If it's a prolonged period of low prices, it's probably not as problematic, because the lease expenditures look like what we see here, where they've been significantly scaled back. But when we worked on Senate Bill 21, for example, and oil prices were a lot higher, then companies were spending a lot of money, because at $110 per barrel, there was a lot more money for them to spend in terms of capital investment. So if we do the scale back in the lower prices, what we're trying to do is keep the minimum tax in place, and that's something that, you know, it stays in the structure, not changing the tax structure at all. All of the parts about the structure stay intact. And that's, again, kind of the bigger picture overhaul work that will happen hopefully through the working group or other interested members who want to take a look at that and figure out if we can do something that works better for the state and is more predictable. But again, we may accomplish that without changing the overall effective tax rate. So I don't want people to think those two are necessarily the same thing. So what you're trying to do here is have just a little lower price protection in there for the companies.
And just to follow up, so I guess I'm just kind of wondering if we're targeting certain price points instead of looking at the whole tax structure as a system and deviating from looking at that whole tax structure as a system just toward price point targeting, I'm kind of wondering how that's going to affect the whole game. You see what I'm saying? When you just try to shoot for this one thing instead of just like we did last year and we actually looked at how it all worked. I guess I'm just getting kind of worried about targeting like this. I don't know. Have you thought about that at all?
Through the chair to Representative Rauscher, so it's intentional that we're doing that, because we're not trying to do the fundamental overhaul bill this year, because we see what happened last year and the year prior, and it consumes all of the time of the legislature, and we need to really put the time in on that. And that's the purpose of the working group, so that this bipartisan, bicameral group of people can work through in a thoughtful way and have access to the consultants and consider what something might look like that can work a little bit better. One of the biggest concerns is that per barrel credit, because that really has a dramatic effect that people did not understand well. They didn't understand well at the time that the Senate Bill 21 was passed. And that is the problem that keeps us in the minimum tax for so long. And so you can see here what happens over that price range with the different minimum taxes. But the tax per net, you can see, is always the 17 cents. So if we didn't have a minimum tax, instead of just getting $2 per barrel, the state would get 17 cents per barrel of oil. And so the minimum tax is really necessary because that per barrel credit really distorts the math.
And then just one last question. Since you mentioned the consultants, were the consultants consulted on this?
Through the chair to Representative Rauscher, yes. I did have a conversation with one of the consultants on this, and we talked about making the change that you see here for the low price protections. And that the $25 to $40 range would be the area to be most concerned because, again, when prices went that low, in a net profit system, keep in mind net profits means you get to deduct all of your expenses before, right, we consider any taxes. But under a net profit system, in that price range, there's nothing left to tax because the price is so low.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my comment goes back a ways in the discussion, but you had mentioned that BP had came out with some significant earnings yesterday, and I was wondering, and when you analyze that, I know they had sold their building, and they have a significant reduction in corporate tax. So how does the piece that's just oil look like?
Through the chair to Representative Johnson, and maybe you're speaking to the letter that BP dropped off. Without sort of singling out one company and just thinking about it, I guess just using that as an example, because that article had just been out and sort of that's what the Alaska public season is responding to. And so, you know, for example, they said things that weren't included in their report, and just in terms of how I personally evaluate it, whether this is helpful for you or not, I don't know. But they say, you know, our cost of operating taps not included. Well, they get to charge for that. They charge tariffs for, you know, shipping down the line. So, and there are deductions on that. In fact, there have been significant lawsuits on that very point. The cost of operating our marine shipping business, well, we do have transportation deductions, so there are some deductions there. Our cost of our ongoing work in supporting the development of AKLNG, I can't speak to that because I don't know what those costs were, but, of course, I don't know if even everybody at this table supports the AKLNG project. So I don't think for us, you know, that's as relevant because we have to think about funding essential services for Alaskans across the state. But I think that's more for them a business consideration of whether they think it's a viable project and whether it's a good use of the dollars that they have. And then they say our capital investment of $400 million in Prudhoe Bay. Again, we know that some of the increased production that came out of Prudhoe Bay was from well workovers and things like that. So, unfortunately, as a company, they have to do those investments to keep producing oil. And there are capital investment deductions. So, without me and none of us have access to their privileged tax information, it's hard to sort of evaluate just limited information we get from a single page report. So, again, I think our consideration is just how to strike the right balance so that we can meet the demands financially for state services, remain a competitive place to do business, and, you know, have a tax system that works. I think this is a stopgap measure, as I mentioned, because if there is some work or a new proposal, I think that's probably 3 years off before that would be implemented. So this would be a stopgap measure in the interim to help us get through this difficult time. And again, we had said with the first introduction of the bill that I probably wouldn't be looking at this if the prices hadn't stabilized over the $60 mark. But once you get above 50, then we're in the profit margin for sure. I mean, and actually much lower right now. But because we anticipate spending will increase if the prices stay in this range so that folks can go in the other direction and make some capital expenditures, then we still leave some room in there that, you know, that spending could take place and not be damaging.
Co-Chair Tarr, I'm also reminded that the administration in 2016 was proposing an increase from 4 to 5%, and the price band was in that 40. We were not really at 55, but it certainly was in that $40 to $55 range during that time period. It was in the lower part of the range, but it strikes me that the bill is consistent with the administration in that respect. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair. If we can go to the slide, effective severance and ad valorem tax rates paid by oil and gas industry fiscal year 2016. These are on the gross value of at the point of production. Is that right?
Through the chair to Representative Parrish, yes.
Thank you. And it seems to be the case, although most actually uniformly, all of our, everyone from the oil industry is out of that table has refused to say what their effective tax rate has been. It's my understanding that it's right around the 4% mark. Is that your understanding as well?
Through the chair to Representative Parrish, there's no confusion about it because right now, with the way the tax structure works, we are stuck in the minimum tax until about $72. And the minimum tax is a 4% tax at the gross value of the point of production. So effectively, we have a 4% gross tax right now.
Oh, follow up,
Representative Parrish.
And functionally, that's because we give a $8 credit per barrel as against the nominal tax rate, right?
Through the chair to Representative Parrish, it's not entirely because we give the per barrel credit of $8. It's where we give the per barrel credit of $8. And it's because we give the per barrel credit after we've deduct transportation, after we've deduct lease expenditures, and then we apply the 35% tax rate, so you reduce it by essentially a third, and then you add the $8 per barrel credit. So it's the order in which those things happen that makes that per barrel credit have so much power to distort the math.
Thank you. Follow up. Thank you. So, again, looking at this effective severance and ad valorem tax rate, just at a glance, I can see that we are tied with Idaho for the worst share through the severance and ad valorem tax. Only Oklahoma does worse. Meanwhile, Wyoming, Louisiana, Arkansas do at least three times better than we do. Montana, North Dakota, Texas do twice as well, more than twice as well. Utah does better than 50% better than we do.
Your question?
Yes. Do you know why it is that we set our floor at the bottom end?
Through the chair to Representative Parrish, you know, we have the legislative history to look at, and I think that was where the legislature landed. Of course, not everybody supported Senate Bill 21, so if you talk to the people who voted against it, that might be one of the reasons they voted against it. Some people voted for it, thought that was appropriate. So I think that's just where things are. But at the end of your packet, we'll just note that Oklahoma did just pass an increase as part of their funding package. And I guess when people talk about stability, this is the scenario that very much concerns me. There was a teacher strike today, and all the teachers walked out in Oklahoma because they've been fighting for funding for their schools and their low pay. And that's the unstable situation that concerns me. And there's been conversations about doing a citizen initiative because there is a constituency of Alaskans who feel like our tax is so low that the only way that we're going to get the fair, quote-unquote, fair share is through a citizen initiative. To me, that would be the outcome that really destabilizes oil and gas development in Alaska, because it's very difficult to do tax policy via citizen initiative. And if that a measure like that were to pass, and I just want you to consider, think if something like that were on the 2018 ballot, as there is a growing number of Alaskans who are not happy about cuts to the permanent fund or other cuts, I imagine it could pass. And then you'd have a policy in place for 2 years that you couldn't make any changes to. And the potential exists for that to be a very aggressive policy. So I think it's in our best interest and the best interest of the state for us to work together as much as we can to figure out these tough questions. And the increase in Oklahoma went up to the 5%.
Excellent. Thank you.
Representative Johnson, you had an additional question.
I do. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I get to follow up here. So I started this conversation a couple of questions ago with my question of you on your or you started with a discussion of BP's profits margins or profits that it just came out with. And I think there's no question that oil companies have profits. But I guess my concern is we seem like we have this conversation in this committee, and it's driven by what are our internal needs rather than what the external analysis of the oil tax policy is. And I have some concerns about that, because I'm not sure that I want to see our oil companies driven out of Alaska because we can't control our spending, or we can't do this, or we need more money, so we're going to go to the oil companies for it. I know that there was a recent article in the Wall Street Journal that talks about the trade war worries driving the price of oil down internationally and keeping it consistently down. So here we are, nearly to the 90th day. We had this bill introduced early on, not the CS, but we just had that CS introduced tonight. It just seems like we're talking about stopgap, last-minute tax policy destabilization. And I'm trying to not just throw this out there as no, 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 but on the other hand, I'm not sure what we're doing here as far as process. I have some real concerns with this.
Representative Johnson, can you tell us what those concerns are?
Well, I think I just did.
Well, I realize that.
I'll just go through it again if you'd like. I have concerns that our tax policy is driven by the internal needs of the state rather than a thorough analysis of what is happening in oil taxes throughout the internationally or in the world market or so on. And so my concern and my question is, here we are at the last of the session. We've been told we've got a stopgap piece of legislation before us. I'm concerned about destabilization of our tax policy. Is that clear?
Yes. You'll see a lot of legislation typically pass in the last 2 weeks. But Representative Tarr, do you want to discuss this?
Through the chair to Representative Johnson, appreciate those points. We did introduce this very early in the session so that it would be in people's minds as something that might be considered. And as things have progressed and we've been looking at how things are going to come together and where things might be funded, this has come up as a potential item for consideration. And that's where we're at today, is just presenting the new CS for your consideration. I understand the concern. I share some of those same concerns. I, again, think that we've sort of sold ourselves short, that the minimum tax of 4% is, I think you can argue, appropriate in the lower tax range, in the lower price range, pardon me. But once we get above 50, 4% is very, very low. And again, we're trying to strike the balance between our responsibilities of meeting the needs of Alaskans that we represent while also being a good place to do business and a good place for investment. And it's not an easy task.
Any other questions? Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, if we could go back to your other possible considerations, right there. Yeah, I don't see the royalty line on there, and you know, we, you know, we have a 12.5% share. So if the tax is zero on, you know, on the, our royalty share is a huge component. And I guess the thing that I struggle with, and I know we talk about this now and again about, we kind of set aside and ignore the royalty share, but the fact is you can have a great big high tax and no production and it doesn't matter. You know, the focus needs to be on the production, the investment necessary to encourage and increase that production, and the exploration necessary to make that happen. And I'm looking at this one here. We have mm-hmm. you're breaking down all the dollars by mm-hmm. Right there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when you're going down like minimum tax $2. Well, there, mm-hmm. that line that you've got vacant there. I mean, that's the royalty share is 12.5%, right? So it's like $6 or I don't know. It's a very significant component there that's multiple times larger than your tax. And I just think that we discount that too often and ignore it too often. I think that we really need to focus on you know what we can do to attract the investment and the exploration necessary to make more production.
Through the chair to Representative Birch, I don't think you and I disagree on that, mm-hmm. but people have to remember that a barrel is going to be a taxable barrel or it's going to be a royalty barrel. One barrel is not both things. So this is what's happening with taxable barrels, but that's why we've made sure to include this chart so folks can see the accompanying royalty barrels. Now, one of the considerations for the working group and anybody who wants to participate in that is that what you'll see happening in other jurisdictions is the royalty rate is really increasing. The 12.5% is pretty low. That's what we have on our North Slope fields, the older fields. The newer royalty amount you'll see on the newer leases is the 16.26, I think, is the percentage. It's the higher royalty rate, but you'll see in some other jurisdictions they've done nearly what you suggest. And that's something we can consider. We could do a gross tax. We can continue with a net profits tax and make adjustments to it that delink it from the price. We could consider just new leases having a higher royalty amount, and then we wouldn't have to have so many debates about taxes. I think those are all really fair points and things that we should spend a lot of time considering, and I've spent at least like 200 hours thinking about in the last couple of years. So, I am looking forward to spending more time thinking about those things, but today, what we have is Senate Bill 21 tax structure to work with and the component of the minimum tax that's under consideration tonight.
Follow up. Yeah, I think where we're missing the mark with this slide, you can't just produce taxable barrels and just produce royalty barrels. They all come out of the ground at the same time. So when frankly everybody's oil gets put together and it comes down the pipeline together, and there's a metering station that's very accurately measures everything. So I think it's not really accurate to say, well, this is a royal, you know, I think the barrels come out of the ground and there's an allocation that for our royalty share, and the taxable component is, I mean, they all come out of the ground at the same time. And I think that it's fair to say that the more production you have, the more royalty revenue you have. Thank you.
Representative Parrish and then Rauscher.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair to Representative Tarr. Has there been any rigorous and peer-reviewed work done on how much of a subsidy you have to give to an industry for it to produce more?
Through the chair to Representative Parrish, I think that's probably a difficult question to answer. What I look to is the information that's been provided to us from Department of Revenue. I think we've spent roughly $6 billion on the tax credit program. The slide presentation that we saw the beginning of last week for House Bill 331 had the breakdown of those dollars and which projects have gone into production, but there's still some billions of dollars that's been spent for projects that have not led to any new production. And that's something I think we should consider when we think about how we develop a tax system that can work better. I know some people have buyer's remorse with the tax credit program that we have in place. For example, if you look at House Bill 331 and this suggested repayment program, there is a better rate for reimbursement if you reinvest in Alaska. Some people think maybe we should have put some kind of parameters in place about receiving tax credits, that you had to reinvest in Alaska, or you had to have a certain percentage of Alaska hire, or you had to share your data with the state. There are ways we could have brought more value to that tax credit program than we did in its inception, and hopefully those are the lessons learned from that.
Follow up. It's my recollection from that presentation that when I asked a very similar question, I wasn't able to hear a clear answer on how much of that investment would have happened anyways. Was that also your impression?
Through the chair to Representative Parrish, yes. That's been a big point of contention, I would say, since the consideration of Senate Bill 21 and thereafter, because at that time there were a lot of folks that said we didn't need to make that change because, for example, one of the provisions in Senate Bill 21 is the GVR, the gross value production, gross value reduction, and that was going to apply to what's quote-unquote considered new oil under the law. And there were a lot of folks who said that was an unnecessary benefit because that was going to be applied to projects that were already planned, invested in, and about to come online. And then they would receive this reduction, 10% or 20%, depending, and that wasn't necessary. We've since, in House Bill 247, scaled back the GVR reduction slightly in terms of making it have a time limit and not last forever, so we don't miss all of the peak years of production in a new field, but it's difficult to know without seeing more information. And that's one of the things that our consultants have said is we are operating with not enough information.
I'm reminded, Co-Chair Tarr, that the limitation on GVR oil was itself a reform of Senate Bill 21. And so this is similar. I mean, they're totally different issues, but there have been some tweaks to Senate Bill 21. It's not like that hasn't been done at all. Am I right about that?
Well, and through the chair to Representative Josephson, yes. And the credit program has been eliminated altogether. So that's a major, major change.
Okay. I have Representative Rauscher, then Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Earlier, a couple times, I guess we referenced maybe the price, the cost of getting oil out of the ground. And I'm falling in line here with all of these other states that I see. I'm not sure that any of them start backing up trucks full of water again and again and again until thousands of them have dumped water for miles, like 20 or 35 miles long, just to get to a place where they want to build an ice pad and then dump thousands and thousands of more gallons out just so they could build hotels on there for people to live and eat and change their clothes and waste water out and water in and food in. And then all of the service rigs get to park there, and then they work on their machinery and everything before you even get to another ice road that they have to back trucks up to, thousands and thousands and thousands of gallons of water and truckloads before they get to a place where they're all going to work, which they build another one of these giant 1,000 foot by 2,000 foot ice pads so they don't get any footprint on the ground up there, so that the we don't make a footprint at all. We don't. And when they start drilling for oil, they assemble their rig, and then when they're done on May 1st, this all starts right around December, and then on May 1st, they've got to get it all off of there before another week and a half goes by, because all those roads are going to melt, and they'll be. Then they'll be putting some marks out there on the tundra. So they have to disassemble all this and get it all out of there by the middle of May. And I don't think any of these other states are faced with that problem. So I think that the cost is not even a mathematical number in any of this, which I think the representative from Juneau has probably questioned about. at least twice, and when he said, well, look at the line we fall in, and then he wondered about the cost. It is expensive to operate in the state of Alaska. It is expensive. Probably one of the most phenomenal things we'll ever do is the way we go about doing it here in the state of Alaska. And I'm just wondering, are we going to tip the scale to the point where, it's not worth starting the truck up and getting a load of oil and water out of the river or out of the creek or out of the place which they get this water out of, and start backing trucks up to start that process again?
Through the chair to Representative Rauscher, a few things. Keep in mind that we have a net profits tax. So all the spending that you're talking about, remember that line up there, the lease expenditures? Those lease expenditures are broken into two categories, operating expenses and capital expenses. And so some of the costs that you're suggesting would be included in their capital expenditure deductions. Another thing I would mention is that one of the reasons that I've been interested in climate change is that the season in which they can build the ice roads is shortening, and that is a result of the changing climate. That does make it more expensive because it delays projects, you know, and could add a year. So I think, you know, we just recently had that conversation about the changing climate, and I think that's something we want to keep in mind when we consider that. And then third thing I would say is last year we put $10 million into the A-STAR project, and that's the beginnings of discussion about developing a permanent road system. And that, I think, is another thing that we need to consider for the working group or whatever group of people want to work on this, is perhaps, going back to Representative Parrish's questions, investing in credits isn't where the state wants to put our money, but instead maybe we want to invest in infrastructure that can benefit all of the players on the North Slope or elsewhere.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to say that's probably why we fall in where we do on this line of when you asked why our percentage is the way it is, because the extra added cost is where I was going with that. So,
through the chair to Representative Rauscher, well, today it's because we have a hard minimum tax of 4%, and that's what's putting us, you know, into that lower space. That isn't really a reflection of the cost because we have it set at 4% regardless of what the cost is. On the other side, when you start to have spending and you truly get into the net profit system, that's more a reflection of the cost.
Through the chair.
Follow up?
Yeah, the 13.4 we couldn't afford because we have to do all that is all I'm saying.
The original Senate Bill 21, interestingly enough, from Senate from Governor Parnell, had a 25% tax rate.
Well, we won't go there because we can go for a long time on this discussion. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I feel like I'm reliving last year a little bit, even though we said we weren't going to have a tax bill this year. Last year we talked a lot about production, and last year we had an upswing in production, and I think we talked about that as being a positive, something we wanted to see more of. Now it's down slightly, again this January, I believe, or this quarter from last year. But it's a simple economic principle that if you tax something more, you'll get less of it. I guess it just seems backwards to have the lower tax at the lesser production, and as we go up, we have higher taxes. I mean, it's just, if we want to encourage production, we shouldn't be increasing the taxes as we get more production. And I guess that's, or at the higher prices. So, if we want production to be up. So, I mean, and production is going to go along with our increased price. So I guess I feel like there's something that we should evaluate a little bit more there. Just my observation on that, because I think what we want to do with this tax structure is not to cause it to cause production to go down. I mean, it's a big concern for me.
Okay. Representative Parrish and then Tallarico.
Oh, I'll hold.
Okay. Representative Tully.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if it's worth our time or worth our while if someone can actually generate a production cost chart for some of these different jurisdictions. A good example, and I was there last November, you know, when we see a state that's on the top and has the highest tax rate. Of course, the Permian Basin, there are oil wells within 70 miles of not only the refinery, but the tankers as well. So there, you know, we talk about the difference in production. Our pipeline is 800 miles long, and the Permian Basin is not far from Corpus Christi, which is where they fill tankers. So that's kind of our we're in competition. I know it's hard for us sometimes to imagine that, but we're in competition with that. So I think sometimes one of the considerations probably would be production costs, but I don't know if we have if anybody's really created a good chart. I'm not sure I've ever seen a really good one, you know, that has the comparisons that we use for effective tax rate. And then the other question, I guess, would be, and this would be my concern, so if we do this in 2017, according to North Rim Bank, our non-oil and gas construction spending in the state wasn't real bad. It was about $1.57 billion. But I have quite a few people that, from my district, from all over the area, that work in the oil industry, and they had a low year compared to like 13 and 14, but they spent $2.43 billion on oil and gas construction projects, and that's what their spending was throughout the state, which I see that impact. I have a fear that if you impact that, it goes well beyond the oil and gas industry. If we start dropping on that, because that, you know, there's a lot of mom and pop stuff involved there. But I would, if we had an opportunity or there was a way to gather both that effective an expense chart for people, because I think the expenses are dramatically different. And I've been fortunate enough not only to see that in Texas, but to see it, say, for example, in Wyoming. Because you drive between Lander and Riverton, and the oil wells are alongside the road. You know, they're in the right-of-way, actually. Mm-hmm. They're actually in the highway right-of-way. So their access, and they have year-round access. So I could only hope that we would find that somewhere, but we haven't. So that chart would be really good, and then you know, what are our differences in construction spending, and how much do we really bring in from that industry, and where does it go to? Because I think that's at least for me and some of my constituents that obviously work there, and others that provide products for people that work there, that's kind of an important thing, just to see, you know, where that's at. I know it's bounced up and down, obviously, you know. It moves around a lot, depending on what's going on. But if somehow we could produce those, I think that would be important, because it is both of those things, both the cost that it costs you to produce, and then how much reinvestment are we getting from those folks? Because I know I've brought that up to other people, brought those figures up, and they said that can't possibly be right because we built skyscrapers in Anchorage and everything. But actually, it is right. You know, it typically runs about $1 billion more. We get $1 billion more investment in the state from oil and gas than we do all of the other all the other construction spending combined. So it's real money. But I don't know what the actual current. Well, we're not deep into the current year, I guess. So we probably wouldn't have actual yet or anything. But if we can come up with that, I think that would help everybody kind of think about this a little bit.
Through the chair to Representative Tallarico, unfortunately, the companies are not required to give us information like that to let us know exactly what their spending plans are. So I wouldn't be able to put together a document that reflects that. And also, unfortunately, because it's privileged tax information, I've tried in two different tax bills to find a way that legislators could have access to it so we could answer those questions and understand things a little bit better. But have been met with resistance from the industry folks. So, again, we're operating with limited information, which is a challenge. This is from the Department of Revenue when we first introduced the bill. So this is a revenue, shows you at various prices. And so this is, you know, the net tax, the foreign and seven minimum tax. So what you can imagine now, instead of the red line and the green line, you know, that our line would kind of go through the middle of that, right? Because we would stair step it up. So our line would go through the middle, and that shows you, again, it's kind of this price range where we think we're going to operate for the next few years, where the 4% is too low. And then at the end of this, just for folks for consideration as a reminder, this is the chart that shows you at other points in our history what the average tax rate would be. So the 4% is the lowest we've ever had it. And then if you go to the end of this, they did a life cycle analysis, and this probably gets closest to what you were talking about, Representative Tallarico. And you can see if you do the, you know, status quo versus the original version, this hasn't been updated for the committee substitute, but your change in net present value is $1.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Earlier, we had a presentation from the oil and gas consultant regarding a comparison, if you will. I don't know if everybody's seen this chart. And it's basically how much the producers earn for a $60 barrel of oil. This was basically by our legislative oil and gas consultant at a oil and gas 102 presentation in January. But West Texas, it shows about a $31 how much the producer earnings. It shows North Slope at $12 and the New Alaska fields at $1.50. And I think that, you know, I'd be interested in how the consultant that we're using for up here, how they would assess this, because this doesn't appear very attractive for inducing new investment in my view. And I just, you know, and I'm concerned that if we start, you know, cranking it up, there's not a lot of room in here for, you know, and I think even on the chart that you had there, below $60 in the, under the prior tax regime, it actually, we would have received less than we are receiving today. I think everything under, I forget where those numbers crossed, or the charts crossed over, but have you seen this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So this, I mean, to me, that really well represents the problem that we're up against here, is that we have to make sure that we're doing the very best we can to attract mm-hmm. investment.
Through the chair to Representative Birch, based on the information from what we have from Department of Revenue, the PTV is $23.35. The tax would be the $8. So if they're using numbers, you know, AOGA may have information that we don't have access to. I don't know how they would get the information from Texas. It's privileged tax information. I don't know who would share that. I have Department of Revenue information, and that's the information that's available to me for evaluation.
Follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Birch.
Yeah, this is based on the our legislative oil consultant as part of their oil and gas 102 presentation. But we can follow up offline. Thank you.
Representative Parrish.
Looks like Alaska Association of Oil and Gas slide, huh?
Mm-hmm. Source.
So vertical integration is a thing. We don't talk about that much. But I'd like to get it on record that in Alaska there are profits enabled in other parts of the nation. And more directly to that, I can't help but to be skeptical of the promises, the assurances of an industry which, leading up to the referendum on SB 21, the last major oil bill, had pretty good employment up on the North Slope. And immediately after the referendum failed, they laid off several hundred workers. That doesn't engender trust for me. I've trouble. Now, I don't mean any disrespect to the members of the industry. Actually, I think they're doing a fantastic job of protecting the interests of their shareholders. That's their job. The same way our job is to assure a maximum return for our people here. Again, I'd like to know if there's been any rigorous work done on the way that a regime's tax structure, a sovereign's tax structure, affects rate of investment and rate of production. I know a little bit to one of my colleagues' earlier points, I know that right now the proportion of non-residents working on the North Slope has never been higher, so that it also engenders a little bit of skepticism for me. Would you be able to find me if there's any good data on trying to make oneself a really sweet deal, what effect that has on long-term investment and productivity, which slides, ebbs, and flows?
Through the chair to Representative Parrish, I think it's difficult to do sort of the causal relationship that you're suggesting, that we had particular program A or tax structure A that led to, you know, behavior B or investment B, because there's a lot of influence of price is a big factor in terms of whether the companies are going to invest or not, and we have no influence over that. And so if you look historically, that's probably been the dominant factor more than the tax. So then you have the price and the tax as a consideration. I know that it's expensive and more difficult to do work on the North Slope, for example, but then you do have infrastructure that was built decades ago, and that investment's been paid for many years ago. So kind of have to take the whole picture and try to evaluate it. I go back to the numbers I was using, and I'll make sure to send the slide that I go back to all members tonight. But the Department of Revenue can break down between, you know, credits that were invested in, into projects that have led to production and credits that were spent for projects that have led to no new production. And I think that's kind of the best evaluation we have at this time. And rather than looking backward or sort of finger pointing, I hope that we just use each of these exercises as lessons learned and we figure out how to do things better going forward. I think we made a lot of mistakes with that credit program. The one that we're dealing with now is because we said that companies could go and use that credit certificate to borrow from a bank, and that's created a huge problem now, because with the credits unpaid, there are lenders waiting to be paid because they use those certificates. That's a bad thing. I hope that the state of Alaska never does that again. I think that we've learned we could have put some other parameters in there that may have been more beneficial, and so there was more of a win-win situation out of those dollars spent, for example, on exploration work, say at somewhere like Smith Bay, that I don't think there's any potential for that to ever be developed unless the prices go up considerably, because it's 125 miles from existing infrastructure and be very costly to build a pipeline to get that oil into TAPS to then get it available for export. That's probably more dependent on the price than anything else, because at this stage they're not a taxpayer. They're in the exploration phase, and they're not going to explore and move forward with developing a project unless the price is going to support that project. And the way we set it up last year with net operating losses, you know, they'd be able to carry forward all the losses and apply them against any future taxes, so they know there's recovery for the cost that they invest should they get into production, but they probably wouldn't consider developing something like that unless it was the right price environment. Perhaps when we have Department of Revenue come up, there's more that they can offer to that, but with the information I have available, that's what I can offer.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, in response to Representative from Juneau's comment about the oil companies, I guess I know the people in my district are so intertwined as far as their jobs are so intertwined with the oil companies, oil prices. It seems like, you know, whether we're talking about something that's the best for the state or best for our people, for me, I know it goes hand in hand, you know, and I can't separate them out. But I liked what the representative from Healy said about getting someone in to just talk about what is that production forecast and how is it affected by these different things, and maybe even getting, do we still have Rogerio that could come talk to us about this?
through the chair to Representative Johnson, the LBNA consultants are not really available for consideration of this piece of legislation. Their contracts are for more of the long-term work, and I did, as I mentioned, talk to Rich when he was in town and gave the 102 presentation, and that's where we talked about the 7% and the conversation about it potentially being problematic or more concerning for companies in the lower prices. And so that's the feedback I've got from him, and didn't think that the 7% would be too high in the price range that we're discussing. That's a private conversation he and I had. I don't feel like I'm disclosing anything inappropriately by talking about that. It wasn't meant to be a confidential conversation in any way. It's just that I just had a few moments. I wasn't able to attend the 102 presentations. I had a few moments to chat with him while he was in Juneau, and that was what I asked him about.
Well,
although, if I could just say, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to put in a request to Senator Stedman as the chair of Legislative Budget and Audit and ask if you had a particular question, or I think you could go to him as the chair and see if you could submit that question. But all of them have to go through Legislative Budget and Audit because they've been hired by that committee for the purposes of consulting.
Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Johnson.
Well, clearly there's just a lot of unanswered questions on this piece of legislation that it's not quite ready for prime time. So my other question, and this is just a process question, is this piece of legislation tied to the oil tax bond reimbursement, however we might want to do that? Is these two pieces of legislation tied together in any way? And do you expect to see one moved out before the other?
Through the chair to Representative Johnson, they're two separate pieces of legislation, and I wouldn't suggest what's going to happen with either of them. That's the will of the committee.
All right, very good.
Representative Johnson, I sort of hesitate to say this, but the expression which I've heard you use, that something's not ready for prime time, it's a little bit pejorative. It's a little bit insulting, I think. I think there are other ways to phrase your displeasure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How would you like that stated?
That, in your opinion, the bill needs additional work.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the bill needs some additional work.
Okay. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suppose I'd just like to go on record with a request sensible to the concerns of my colleagues about the interlocking nature of an oil tax structure. I would like for us as a committee at some point to agree on what the goals of a tax structure ought to be. And then I would prefer to see that request go to someone like Rogerio, a professional with deep experience in the industry, to come back to us with a tax structure that hopefully we can all agree upon and stand behind for decades to come.
Through the chair to Representative Parrish, we did that last year. We worked closely with him, and that's what led us to the bill that passed the House last year and was not considered favorable by the Senate. So we know what he will say, and that's not included in this committee substitute presentation, but for example, his suggestions have been to delink it from price so much because that makes it very volatile with the price fluctuations. The per barrel credit is problematic because of where it's applied in the equation. The base rate of 35% is really fake and too high, so that's something to consider. He suggests considering taxing off of the PTV if you want to retain a true net profit system. He's, as I mentioned, considered being more thoughtful at the low price environment, and that's reflected in the committee substitute you have here today. He thinks we need much more information. That's a big recommendation of his, and I can show you, for example, if you go to the website for Norway, all of the spending information, and you can even see it in a field-by-field analysis. And that, if we had that kind of information, that would really change the way we could evaluate things and our understandings. But we only can get information as North Slope averages, for example. And so, you know, the lease expenditures are $26.79. I know that's not what it is for every company, and that's why we have the two columns on the right, so you can kind of consider a band of prices to think about that. But where we are today, that's what we have. So that's I don't disagree with that suggestion. If that's the will of the committee and they'd like to come up with some ideas, then that could be informative for the consultants we work with and maybe could lead us to a good place, and I would hope it would be something we could all agree on. I will say last year when we started 111, my goal was to put something in place that we thought could be in place for 5 to 10 years so we could sort of set this matter aside. Unfortunately, we weren't able to accomplish that, but because it was so time-consuming and really brought a lot of work to the, you know, to a standstill as we tried to negotiate that, that's why we're not working on a big overhaul piece of legislation this year, but instead considering just the one piece of the minimum tax.
Okay, I think that's a pretty good stopping point.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we take a 30-second at ease, Madam Chair?
And, sure.
Okay.
I guess the last statement I'll just make, you'll see that 288 is not on the agenda for this week. So we will consider when to bring that back before the body, but the next place that we will go is for public testimony. And so that's the next item when that bill comes back before us. So at this time, let's go ahead and move on in the remaining time that we have to House Bill 315. This is the confidentiality of certain records. Members should have two amendments. These are amendments that were brought to our attention by the department, and so I have agreed to offer them on their behalf, and we have on the line Jennifer Curie from the Department of Law, Christina Carpenter from DEC Division of Environmental Health, and then Dr. Gerlach, our state veterinarian, online. And I'm going to introduce the amendments and then ask them to speak to them since they were brought to us by the department. Oh, pardon me. Just a moment, brief at ease.